from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books and ideas. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. This conversation features Harvard historian and New Yorker columnist Jill Lepore, interviewed by U.S. Congressman Jamie Raskin. They discuss Lepore's book, The Deadline, Essays, before a live audience at the Kentucky Author Forum. This conversation was recorded on September 11th, 2023, at the Kentucky Center in Louisville. Jill Lepore is the David Woods Kemper 41 Professor of American History and Affiliate Professor of Law at Harvard University. She is also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her many books include These Truths, A History of the United States, an international bestseller that was named one of Time magazine's top 10 nonfiction books of the decade. Lepore's The Deadline essays collects 46 of her essays written over the last decade, including three unpublished ones that offer a prismatic portrait of Americans' techno-utopianism, frantic fractiousness, and unprecedented yet armed aimlessness. Lepore has been contributing to The New Yorker since 2005, writing about American history, law, literature, and politics. Her essays and reviews have also appeared in The New York Times, The Times Literary Supplement, The Journal of American History, Foreign Affairs, The Yale Law Journal, American Scholar, and The American Quarterly. They've been translated into many languages and have been widely anthologized, including in collections of the best legal writing and the best technology writing. Congressman Jamie Raskin represents Maryland's 8th Congressional District. He serves as the ranking member on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability. He served as the lead House manager in the second Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Raskin also served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and served three terms on the House Judiciary, Oversight, and Administration Committees. Raskin was a professor of constitutional law for more than a quarter century at American University Washington College of Law. He has authored several books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Unthinkable, Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. We hope you'll enjoy this great podversation with Jill Lepore and Jamie Raskin.
Well, very cool. Welcome to the Kentucky Authors Forum.
Thank you so much.
And welcome to Kentucky. It's my second time here.
Thank you. Thank you. I went and paid tribute at Muhammad Ali's grave today, so I feel anointed.
Well done. And you got your own Louisville Slugger, too?
I got the little mini bat from the tour.
Well, this is an exciting possibility to talk to you about this magnificent new book that I want to brandish for our audience out there, The Deadline, by Jill Lepore. Tell me, as an historian, what the difference is in the intellectual project of these truths from what you do in these essays, which are more snapshot vignettes on anything from Rachel Carson to Eugene Debs to the history of the bicycle and your involvement with bicycles.
In the 19th century, essays were often referred to as fugitive pieces, which I love. So people would publish these collections of fugitive pieces, just meaning that they were sort of fleeting, right? So there's a kind of fleeting quality maybe to the essays and the deadline, whereas These Truths was just this sort of 1,000-page history of the United States that I published a few years back, was really my attempt to truly be a historian instead of kind of also a journalist, which is what I'm also doing when I'm writing essays.
Yeah.
So when I wrote These Truths, I would go to the library every week and get a pile of books because I was writing chronologically. And I have this running joke with the security guard at the library, like, he'd be like, what are you on now? did you get to Andrew Jackson yet? You know, I'd bring a pile of books and read a bunch of books about a period in time, try to write a chapter, bring those books back, get another stack of books, and try to just make sense of the sweep of American history for, like, when I was a kid, there were kind of, like, history books like that. There were, like, national histories, and that really fell out of favor. In the 1970s and 80s. So I was trying to do something.
So you're trying to take it all in.
Yeah, I was trying to take it all in and like big sweeping account that would sort of be like, what is this country and what is this meaning?
So do you favor one of these forms of history over the other?
I prefer writing essays because it's kind of in and out. It's like a, I don't know, it's like a polka instead of a waltz.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Just the pace of it is better for me. Like, I'd rather do a polka.
And that security guard might have looked at you as kind of a fugitive. Like maybe he thought you were taking some books or something. Here's a great fugitive essay you've got in The Deadline, and it revolves around Kentucky. So I thought it's about as good a place as any is to begin. You tell the story of Leela and her brother, John T. Scopes, who grew up in Kentucky, but he ended up going to teach biology in Tennessee and was the subject of a criminal prosecution for teaching evolution against the anti-evolution statute that had been adopted by the Tennessee legislature. You point out something that I didn't know, I'm sure most people don't know, even in Kentucky, which is that there was an effort to pass that very same law in Kentucky, essentially, against the teaching of Darwinism and evolution and different kinds of science. And it was the first place where they went with this campaign, and the Tennessee legislature rejected it. The Kentucky legislature rejected it. The Tennessee legislature adopted it. So now you use this as a launching pad to talk about the current move against the teaching of history about Jim Crow, apartheid in America, racism, slavery, which the governor of Florida assures us now was just a skills training mass apprenticeship program. But you take what happened almost exactly a century ago with respect to evolution and Darwin, and then you juxtapose it with what's going on today. Tell us about what are the continuities and discontinuities in these two movements against education.
I found that really fun to research. So this was a case where sometimes explaining how essay came to be explains what it tries to do. So there are all these bans going on, banning critical race theory. So not just sort of require state legislatures requiring you must teach these 25 primary source documents. Every school child must read Ronald Reagan's Time for Choosing or something, whatever these kind of requirements. There were also bans. And so I was asked to try to kind of make sense of that historically. And the jostling over it in state legislatures had been fairly aggressively reported. Like people knew what states were doing what, and there were the funny jokes about the this and that. But I was sort of baffled by the phrase parents' rights, because I hadn't really heard it. I felt like I hadn't heard that as part of like American political discourse. I got really curious, like, how do these claims for, you know, mandated school curriculums and censored books, how do they hinge themselves to this notion of parental rights? Like, where did this come from? And that's where I kind of went diving in and looking for the origins of parents' rights as a political claim. And it dates to the 1920s, maybe a little bit earlier even. And it's most widely used in these attempts to ban the teaching of evolution in public schools, chiefly in the South. And I had known nothing about the Kentucky story, so it's in 1922. So the time I was working on the piece was 2022. It had a nice symmetry. It was 100 years ago that Kentucky defeated a proposal by a single vote in the Kentucky legislature to ban the teaching of evolution. And so I liked that story because I didn't know that John Scopes was from Kentucky. I thought he was from Tennessee, and I didn't know he had a sister, and I didn't know she was a teacher, and she got fired. She was teaching math, but she got fired for being unwilling to denounce Shtut and Paducah, she taught algebra in Paducah, but somehow the fact that she wouldn't denounce the teaching of evolution meant that she lost her job. So I like that story. I like the way of animating the tale, giving John Scopes a kind of backstory in Kentucky, and also seeing how does the legislature succeed in defeating such a motion. But what I really had not understood at all was the origins and then the legacy of parents' rights as a claim. So parents' rights as a claim emerges because school was not compulsory anywhere in the United States. It wasn't generally even offered or free for most, you know, until the 1830s or 40s. And then it was not universal free public schooling. It was sort of maybe boys could maybe get, you know, white boys could maybe get free schooling. But in the 1880s and 1890s, the very beginnings of the Progressive Era, states started mandating that children between the ages of, say, 6 and 16 need to be in school during the day for 9 or 10 months out of the year.
As a way to prevent them from being exploited.
Essentially
as labor,
a way
right?
to prevent. So it's really, it's the Gilded Age. Children, especially children of immigrants, and in the South, children of freedmen and women, are working from very, very young ages in terrible conditions in factories. And there's a lot of angst about it. And, you know, you could think of like Jacob Riis and the photographs and tenements. But there's not really much that can be done about it, especially because whenever states pass child labor laws that try to regulate the employment of children, they go to the Supreme Court, and this laissez-faire Supreme Court says that interferes with the liberty of contract, and so all those child labor laws are declared unconstitutional. So there's an effort to pass an amendment to the Constitution, making the regulation of child labor constitutional, but that is also met with all kinds of opposition from, you know, exactly the factory forces. So instead, progressives are like, okay, well, what we can do if we can't ban employing children, we can require children to go to school. It's just we can meet the same objective. And actually, it's a twofer because we would really like to have children get free public school. So that happens. But then once children start to go to school, by the 1910s, with the emergence of kind of the study of virology and microbiology, people are like, well, if children are all going to go to school, they need to be vaccinated. So then in addition to compulsory education laws, there are compulsory vaccination laws. So now parents who want to keep their kids at home to work on the farm, they have to send them to school and they have to get them vaccinated. And then the way that the political opponents of universal free childhood education deal with that is by saying, look what they're teaching them. Look what they're teaching your children. You have a right as parents to keep them home, to refuse to have them vaccinated, to not send them to school, and to decide what school books they will use. So this sort of...
And that was taking place a century ago.
This was a century ago, and it's really the origins of our kind of modern cultural war configuration, because there's a very articulated conservative position and there's a progressive position. And the progressive kind of... the slate of progressive reforms is a lot to take in one generation. You're used to keeping your kids at home and working them on the farm and teaching them from the Bible, and then in a year, suddenly you have to send your kid to school every day, get them vaccinated, and they're reading stuff that you've never even heard of before. So it is a really fast, sweeping change, and there's a big reaction against it. One of the things I loved about the Kentucky story, though, is the law that was proposed in the Kentucky legislature would also affected the university. The University of Kentucky had a new and really progressive university president, Frank McVey, is I think his name. He was this really interesting economist from Wisconsin, the, you know, kind of kid of like progressive Republicans in Wisconsin. And he would not have it. He was like, I'm gonna fight this because I cannot have, this is before sort of our modern notions of academic freedom, but he's like, I cannot have the state legislature passed a law saying we can't teach evolution. Like, it's the basis of all the science courses that we teach. All the biological science courses kind of require this. And he engaged in this very clever campaign to defeat it. As soon as he heard about the bill, he sent telegrams to like 50 people across the country who would be really influential, including members of the clergy and important philosophers, and said, like, this is what's going to be voted on in our state. Please send comments, collect. And he had arranged in advance with newspapers across Kentucky to publish all the responses, and they did. And he managed to defeat the thing. So it's actually a really interesting political response, because what he also did was he wrote an open letter to the people of Kentucky, and he said, you know, evolution is not what you think it is. It's not a conspiracy against the idea that there is a God or that you can't teach your children biblical origins stories anymore. Like, it is a theory of change and how change happens biologically. It's not what people who are trying to defeat the teaching of evolution are telling you that it is. So he did this kind of pretty big public education campaign at the same time.
Yeah. And you have a beautiful quote from Leela Scopes at the end to that effect, basically, about how she sees real beauty in the idea that God created evolution.
And
that
Well,
you use the history of the country to illuminate the struggles of the present. I mean, how much of that is a deliberate choice on your part, where you're setting out to say, let's do an historical exegesis to determine what are the contours of a particular political conflict we're having?
Yeah. I think that's kind of my beat as a magazine, as a contributor to the magazine. So something's brewing and it's hard to know, hard to get a vantage on it. And it seems so consuming and there's a lot of chatter around it.
Yeah.
My job is to pull back from that and be like, where did this come from? What's something that I can discover about where this comes from that might be illuminating and might shake people out of their kind of overdetermined
positions about it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're undoubtedly reliving a lot of old controversies.
Yeah.
So that clearly is one commanding impulse in your approach to your job or your multiple jobs, because you're a journalist with The New Yorker, but you're also a college professor, and now you're also a law professor at Harvard too, right? So, but there's another side that I picked up on, which I would just like your comment on. There's a kind of subversive, iconoclastic, dethroning side to you, where you there's certain people who seem to catch your eye, and then you kind of go after them a little bit. One of the people that you take down in your inimitably gentle way, but nonetheless, I think take down, is a Harvard Business School professor named Clayton Christensen, who's the author of The Innovator's Dilemma and is the mastermind behind the whole idea of disruption or innovative disruption. And you kind of disassemble the whole idea and debunk it from a lot of different angles, including the business angle. And I just wonder, well, first of all, what was your intention there? But secondly, like, what gives you the courage to go into somebody else's field and discipline and blow the whole thing up like that? So,
yeah.
And tell me if I'm reading you wrong.
No, I mean, there are... Yeah, there's a kind of crusading, muckraking...
intellectual muckraking.
...piece of how I approach things. And it's, you know, I have enormous respect for most work that most people do. Like, I don't love the takedown. Like, I actually, it just makes me extremely anxious. I have a piece recently in The New Yorker that's about Elon Musk that's pretty tough. And he's a person who people make a lot of jokes about, but is wildly indulged. His worldview is really taken for granted, but his actual worldview is really derivative of disruptive innovation. He came of age in the moment of the celebration of disruptive innovation as the new gospel that would rule capitalism worldwide, but is also kind of the altar on which we, you know, worship the Silicon Valley entrepreneur, right? That is the faith that they do this woo, woo, woo. And we're supposed to say that's great.
That's another big Joel Lepore word, hooey. I noticed that. I think I noted it 6 or 7 times in the book.
That's from Nero Wolf. Nero Wolf says hooey all the time.
Yeah.
So with Clayton Christensen.
Yeah. Explain the hooey to everybody about
innovative
disruption.
There was that piece is maybe 10 years old, maybe it's 2013, 2014. There was a moment when I felt that I had really never heard the word disruption except to refer to, you know, my sixth grader and his behavior in class. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I thought disruptive meant. And then suddenly it was everywhere. And like, we needed to be disruptively innovating. And on campus, we must disruptively innovate. And it just seemed like a nonsense word to me. Like, and it's a kind of a recycling of Schumpeter's creative destruction, right? Like, you need to blow something up and just set aside everything that anyone thinks they know about something. What you bring to your project is your ignorance of it. And then you could think about it in a fresh way. And in the business development model, instead of making what Christensen called sustaining innovations, like tinkering around the edges of your product and making a little bit better each year for your established customers, you should just chuck the whole thing aside and disruptively innovate, create something completely different that might be really junky at first, but would eventually dismantle the whole industry. So that you might have a taxi service, say, and, you know, maybe you're making it a little bit better. You have a call center, you have response time, you're doing some work to try to make your taxi service more responsive to your community. You get better licensing requirements for your drivers or whatever. You're upgrading your cars. These are sustaining innovations, but they're not fundamentally changing the nature of the work that you are doing. Well, Uber is disruptively innovating. Uber doesn't care about any of the things that you have cared about as a taxi service. Or let's say you're involved in public transportation. Well, Uber's going to come along and dismantle that through disruptive innovation. And so Uber would say, not speaking for Uber, but in my imagination, you know, things like the consequences for mass transit or traffic or pollution or wage inequality or the lack of benefits for these drivers in this new gig, these don't matter. We're disruptively innovating. Therefore, please give us money. Like that, the concerns that actually we might think ethical businessmen and women might have, right, with the effect of changes to an industry on a labor system, on questions around environmental justice in a neighborhood, or, you know, the availability of transportation to different communities. These don't matter because you're disruptively innovating. And what you bring to it is you don't care and you don't know, but you can fix it. And so I would be at like faculty meetings and the deans would be like, we're bringing in some disruptive innovators to tell us how we can change what we do. And they'd be like, but they don't know anything and they don't care about anything. And why would we listen to them? My editor asked me if I would write something about the kind of cult of sudden sort of grasp of disruptive innovation. And I was like, well, I wouldn't, why would I bother? Nobody believes it's obviously hooey. Like, it's obviously, like, it's just such obviously rank
hooey.
I'm trying not to curse because this is televised. Yeah. And then he's like, well, why don't you think about it? And then that spring, the New York Times, this was actually leaked, had a disruptive innovation report. Because the New York Times wanted to disruptively innovate because BuzzFeed News was getting a lot of traffic. And so I remember reading the PDF online of the disruptive innovation recommendations for the New York Times, and it basically was like, Clayton Christensen has explained that disruptive innovation works this way, like charts and graphs as if it's like a science. And what we need to do is become more like BuzzFeed, and here's how we'll do it. And I was like, but the New York Times, I'm going to lose the New York Times for this? Like, I was very like frustrated that people involved, the New York Times needed to make a lot of changes, no doubt about it. But to do so by taking on faith a model of change that had no empirical foundation was concerning.
Well, and that's one of your big points, right? That the overwhelming number of disruptive innovators fail and a lot of non-disruptive, non-innovators succeed. And so it's hard to see exactly what the scientific meaning is of it. And it has, I think you show, pretty much zero predictive value about what's going to happen. So what is it really?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's,
it seems like a little bit of takedown of business school academia.
I didn't say that. You said that. I'm
being a disruptor.
I think that the, I mean, so the way the essay began, or the way the writing of the essay is, it's the story of how I used to work at the Harvard Business School as a secretary.
Oh, and I see where this is going.
And so, and so it's a little bit of like, wow, these people are paid. I remember for the longest time, all my furniture and all my apartments came from the Harvard Business School because they're always renovating the buildings. Uh-huh. And they would have like these dumpsters. And I'd like borrow a car from a friend and be like, look, we could all go get desks. Oh, look, we can all go get sofas. And like everybody I knew, we would just go like get all of our furniture from the dumpsters at the business school. So I had a jaundiced view of the business academy.
You were getting paid in furniture.
I was paid only in furniture. So anyway, so for the Christians, I was genuinely curious, like, why do people believe this? And I went back and I read the dissertation and I looked at all the case studies and then I redid the work. And it just doesn't, it cannot be proven. It has a kind of cult-like quality, and a lot of business school publications have a kind of like worship the guru thing, and that, you know, it participates in the same sort of veneration that Silicon Valley does, and it's always like a guy in a black t-shirt and a black blazer and some fun zippy little sneakers who walks out onto a dark stage, and you know, the screen pops up behind him, and you're like, "Ooh, like that's," and I just don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Yeah, that's clear. Yeah. all right. Well, let's talk about some things you like. Actually, before we get to some things you really like, why don't we talk about some things I wasn't quite sure, like sort of how you really felt. You had a fascinating essay that was written in 2018 about Barbie and the Bratz dolls and the intellectual property struggle and Judge Kaczynski, who I think gets somewhat of the Jill Lepore treatment in that essay. And, did you see the movie? What did you think about, did you see the movie in conjunction with Oppenheimer, and you know, how did you relate to these two as intertwined?
Did you see? Did you do the double feature?
I didn't go at the same time, but I've seen both of them. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are treacherous waters. I've discovered. I did see both of the movies. I didn't see them as a double feature.
Yeah.
I think that would have been really interesting. When I went to see Barbie, it was sold out, and there were people who came dressed up, and they cheered, and I felt completely alienated from the audience.
It was like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
It was the whole, and it was really interesting to see the audience response was very intense.
Yeah.
The article in this collection is called Valley of the Dolls, and it's about this famous intellectual property battle between the maker of Bratz and Mattel that makes Barbie.
Yeah. I feel like they almost quoted you at the beginning of the movie where they said, up until Barbie, all the dolls were babies.
And yes,
all
the, yeah.
But,
yeah,
but they true. But they didn't.
Yeah, they ripped me off.
Ripped you off a little bit there. I don't know. It sounded very Jill Lepore to me after, because I'd read your essay before.
Uh-huh. And, yeah. Oh, before you saw the movie. So yeah. So the article is really very little about Barbie as Barbie.
Yeah.
I went and read Ruth Handler, the founder of, the creator of Barbie at Mattel. Her papers are at the Radcliffe Library, at the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe. So I went and read her papers, and that was really fun. And it was a fun piece to write. But then when this book came out, a reporter was doing like a Q&A with me for Time magazine or something. And she said, "Oh, I saw you wrote something about Barbie. What did you think of the movie?" And I was like, "Please, you don't want to quote me on this. So you really want to put me on the spot about Barbie?" She's like, "Yeah, I really want to know." She was lovely. I was like, okay, well, I really hated the movie. And I gave my little explanation of why I did not like the film. And like a friend sent me like a screenshot the next day of like a headline from Time magazine that was like, "Why Jill Lepore Hates Barbie." And like we had this whole long conversation about the impeachment and the insurrection and American politics and the pandemic. And like, this was the takeaway. So I thought that was really interesting to be reduced to,
I'm going to have to go look that one up.
No, don't. I'll tell you. Okay. I can give you the answer. The answer in brief is, so the story of Barbie, and no spoilers for those few people in the audience who have not seen it, is basically a recycling of a feminist utopian novel written in, I think, 1915 by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. It's called Her Land. Mm-hmm. And it's about this land of only women, and then these men come, and what happens.
Women's constitution.
It's the same story. And it was more than a century ago, and it was before women had the right to vote in the United States. And it did a certain kind of political work. It was a kind of feminist consciousness-raising story. And that you could retell that a century later and have people being like, "My consciousness has been raised by Barbie," is about the most depressing thing that I, as a feminist, have seen in my lifetime. So that was my controversial thing.
You've got an essay on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, speaking of strong feminists. In it, you say that trivialization is not tribute. And you seem to think that the real meaning and the complex legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been trivialized by some of the pop deification of the late Justice. Why don't you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, and I think she is, you know, is an incredible intellectual and really important constitutional thinker and, you know, a defining justice. But I think she, especially the last 10 years or so of her life, kind of participated in that. There are a lot of concerns about what justices do in public and where those lines are. And, you know, to the degree there is such a thing as a national conversation, presumably we're kind of having one now.
About there are no lines, by the way.
Where those lines maybe should be.
Every justice has his own sugar daddy at this point.
Yeah, but every justice shouldn't be a bobblehead either, right? Yeah. Like, those are two sides of the same coin, right?
Yeah.
And so I think some of the sort of fetishization of the celebrityification of Ginsburg, mm-hmm. The kind of like SNL, the Ginsburg, the Kate McKinnon thing, you know, but that's not, Ginsburg's not responsible for that, but she, you know, goes on the Colbert Show and does her workout and speaks in stadiums before tens of thousands of people. Those are, I'm uncomfortable with that, with Supreme Court justices doing those things. That's not really what the piece that I wrote about Ginsburg, the piece I wrote about Ginsburg was about how she was not a hero to feminists at the time that Clinton nominated her to the court.
He thought the women's rights groups would
oppose her, and he was right. And there, too, I went to the Schlesinger Library for the History of Women at Radcliffe, and I read the correspondence in Now's papers and Narell's papers, and they did not want Ginsburg because she had given the Madison lecture earlier that year in which she regretted the argument that the majority made in Roe.
Yeah.
She had a different, as everyone, people know the story, she had a different case as an advocate for the director of the Women's Rights Program for the ACLU. She had a different case that she wanted to go forward to the Supreme Court. And it was derailed by Roe going forward. And her case was about an Air Force officer who was being forced by the Air Force to have an abortion in order to stay in the service. And she liked that case because it was about choice, but it wasn't fighting for the right to have an abortion. Yeah. It was fighting for the right to choose.
And it would have been a better way to establish.
She thought it would have been a better way. It would have been more durable.
Yeah. And
of course, would have been an equal protection argument, not a privacy argument.
And with the Dobbs decision, well, it could have gone in either direction. I mean, it could have been a privacy case too. But in any event, you know, the Dobbs decision obliterating a woman's right to choose means that a state could compel women to have abortions or to be sterilized, which is a more historically salient example, I guess, because there were tens of thousands of women who were sterilized by states, especially in Virginia in the 19th and early 20th century. Well, there's a lot of politics in the book, and you're a political person, clearly, but you also have a strong whimsical side. And one of my favorite essays in here is the one you did about Robert Ripley and Believe It or Not. What one of your colleagues at The New Yorker wrote about Robert Ripley's Believe It or Not, there was also a biography of it. And you say, you know, both of these writers seem to have, you know, something of a parallel obsession with the bizarre, the weird, you know, idiosyncratic. And it seems like you've got a little bit of that,
I have that too.
Yeah.
I totally have that.
Yeah. What did you think about Robert Ripley?
Oh, I'm not a Robert Ripley fan. Yeah. And he's one of these guys where the sort of indulgence of his own oddity. And so Robert Ripley was an actual guy. He did Believe It or Not as a newspaper column and then a radio show and then movie shorts. It wasn't really a TV thing. It was really movie shorts. And he had an auditorium on ODDI, the auditorium. And he would collect oddities, and he was like a Barnum-like collector of freaks and freakish people. But he also collected women from around the world who were apparently, you know, there's some intimation that they were trapped in his house and they could never leave. And I mean, he was gross. Like, he was actually gross. And then, but then,
Believe it or not.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's actually really not that surprising that he was gross, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you read, there's a lot of, like, if you read 30s journalism, there's because The New Yorker was really big on the kind of day in the life of the dog catcher story, right, where they find some sort of ordinary, maybe not ordinary person whose life was just fascinating. And Jeffrey Hellman, who wrote the profile of Ripley, wrote a lot of those, like, here's this guy, you know, the quirky guy, he's a trash collector, but let me tell you, you know. And he had that, let me collect the odd guy stories. And so it was like the odd guy collector writing about the collector of odd women. And the whole thing just has a kind of unsavory quality to it.
Yeah.
But working on that made me think a lot about how I like to collect. Like, I have, there's a piece in here where I go to meet the guy who invented freezing the heads of dead people to bring them back in the future.
Yeah. I noticed that one.
One's also, that's me participating in the very thing that I think is creepy. So yeah. it's my attempt to reckon with my own proclivity.
Yeah. You're a beautiful writer. You pay attention to the written word. The essays are easily digestible. And you write in one of the essays about the history of the novel and fiction and history. You make the point, which I'd never seen before, but that the old novels used to use the word history on the cover of the books and say a history of something made up, you know. And but then you talk about the gender politics of nonfiction historical writing and fiction, and how women were excluded for so long from historical writing because that was men's stuff. It was men's fields. It was government. It was politics. It was business and so on. And that fiction became a way where women could occupy cultural terrain safely and use their imaginations and so on. And there's still traces of that today when you think about, like, who reads what,
yeah.
who buys what,
yeah.
and
yeah.
so on. And I wonder where you fit into that whole taxonomy that you set forth in that essay.
Yeah. I've always been really sort of baffled by it and troubled by it. But the essay makes the argument that in the 18th century, when the novel is invented, that's why it's called the novel, because it's new, it's novel. It emerges in opposition to what is becoming a more empirical version of the history book, which is, you know, for the purposes of training young statesmen, we shall read the lives of great statesmen of the past. And the novel really is about private life, domestic life, the kind of emergence of kind of the middle class domestic life of England. And it tends to be about the private lives of women. And then it tends to be written by women. And the two genres just really do diverge in that way. And what gets lost, what gets jettisoned as feminine from the writing of history is anything like funny or passionate or, you know, involving sympathy or empathy, rage or humor, private life, childbirth, you know, miscarriages, children. Like, just there's a whole vast realm of human experience and human expression that is forbidden in the writing of history. And you see it down to our day in that, like, Father's Day will roll around and you can be sure there'll be some 600-page biography of Patton that you can get for your dad for Father's Day through the History Book Club, you know? And it will sell in the gazillions, and no fathers will ever read it. I think that's awesome.
That's what the fireplace is for, the mantle.
That's right. Right. That's what the mantle is for. Yeah. And, you know, not that we shouldn't reevaluate Patton every once in a while, but that's not what I do or why. I think of myself mostly as a writer. I happen to write history. But I've tried in so many ways to see if I could sort of shake up the writing of history in that public, in that kind of Barnes & Noble bookshore, in that what's on that mantle. So some years back, I wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin's sister, Jane Franklin, who is, you know, Franklin always said his life was the American allegory. He was an allegory for, you know, the rags to riches story of America.
Yeah.
Industry brings wealth and reputation. But really, Jane is she's rags to rags. She gets pregnant and marries when she's 15. She has 12 children, 11 of them die. She lives in poverty her whole life. So I wanted to write a biography of her as kind of an allegory in the spirit of Franklin's autobiography.
Yeah.
And even like my publisher sent me the jacket of the book. I don't know if people remember Holly Hobby, the little doll. So it was like a ye oldie colonial dame silhouette of like a granny on a rocking chair with knitting needles, like Holly Hobby style. Like, as if I'd written, like, an American Girl doll YA book about cute little Jeannie Franklin. Like, I just was like, well, I thought I wrote this, like, badass biography that was shaking up everything about biography and the conventions of historical writing, where our politics come from, what the American story is, the canvas of American history. And it was like, but it's little Jane Franklin. I was that wasn't a good day.
But it didn't go in the book, did it?
No. Something else went in the book that I also didn't really like. But there was no. It was my vision for what such a book should be. Like, there's not like a visual shorthand for it in the publishing industry.
Yeah.
You know, like the killer biography of the dead poor woman.
Yeah.
What do you picture? Like, is it going to be big type? Is it going to be really typographical as a jacket? Is it going to be a portrait? Like, there's no portrait of her. She was too poor.
Yeah.
Are they going to invent something? Like, it just, we don't have the even language for that. You can picture the novel version. It would look like the back shot of any sanitary napkin ad. Like, it would just be like that. Like, there'd be a woman sitting on a rock on the coast of Maine looking moodily at the waves.
Yeah.
My cycle. That you can picture that.
Yeah.
But you can't picture the like, yeah.
Look, this is my first interview. So it's a different experience for me, Jill. Just a footnote on that, because I haven't read your book on Ben Franklin's sister.
Nobody has. That's what happens when you write about a poor woman.
You should have gone with the doll silhouette.
I don't know. Then, yeah.
But and I was always kind of a Franklin fan. I mean,
I love Franklin.
He was an abolitionist and he was an Enlightenment guy. You know, he fled Puritan Boston.
Yeah, and he's very funny.
He's got a dirty mind.
He's got a very dirty mind. Yeah, he's funny. He's a very funny guy. I love Franklin.
But, well, say a word, if you would, then, about the times that we're in and how a lot of people who were considered for their day visionary or forward-thinking or progressive get taken down. I mean, I can imagine reading your book about Ben Franklin and his sister and saying, this guy had a lot of money. I mean, he was Mr. Penny Saved as a penny earned and industry and thrift, and he willed all this money to Philadelphia. They're still spending his money, you know, it pays for everything. Did he not help his sister out? But what do you do about the way that Jefferson has fallen so much in terms of American public opinion?
Yeah.
Because people are reckoning with the fact that he, despite everything that he knew and even what he might have felt, he stood with the slave system.
Yeah. That is a really interesting question. And I have several different things to say about it, and I'll try not to take too much time. But one is, when I was in graduate school, we were taught the founders didn't know that slavery was wrong, and so therefore we shouldn't blame them for not knowing. I know.
Yeah, you went to that new college created by Governor DeSantis.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what we were actually taught. Yeah. And, you know, Frederick Douglass famously said, well, everybody who was enslaved knew it was wrong. Like, how is that hard to, like...
Tom Paine knew it was wrong.
Ben Franklin knew it was wrong. How I dealt with that, for instance, in These Truths, where I have to... There's a chapter I'm talking about the writing of the Constitution, and we need to learn a lot about James Madison. Well, it happens that there's a really interesting letter that Madison writes home when he's in Philadelphia for the Continental Congress, not for the Constitutional Convention. And Philadelphia, partly through the Abolition Society that Franklin is the president of, has passed an abolition law in 1780. And you cannot sell another human being in Philadelphia. And Madison has had this guy with him. He calls him Billy, a human being that is his family's property. And he has to go back home to Virginia. And he writes to his dad, and he's like, I don't know what to do. I can't bring Billy home because in Philadelphia, he's been free. And when he goes home, he's going to tell everybody like what freedom is, and they're just going to leave. So I can't bring him home. And I can't sell him because that's not legal here. And I don't really know what to do because I need some money because I want to buy Hobbes's Leviathan from a book sale. Like, it's like actually what the, like, and so I put that story in there. And in the end, he ends up, William Gardner, who is Billy, stays in Philadelphia as a free man. He ends up marrying a woman who was a laundress to Thomas Jefferson, and they start a family. And that is a founding story of the United States. But just kind of put that, what I do there is just to put that out for the reader.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he doesn't understand all of this. He freedom's contagious. It's an infection that will spread. And he's just dealing with this in this very incomplete way. On the other hand, when I have students come to say, I can't read this book because it was written by a racist. I mean, I've had students refuse to read the Dred Scott decision of Roger Taney, the Supreme Court decision that basically leads to the Civil War from 1857, that is required reading in courses, and I believe should be.
Well, he would agree with DeSantis and those guys because they say you shouldn't be able to teach the doctrine that one race is superior to another. Yeah. So you can't teach the Dred Scott decision.
You can't teach most of American history. But there are progressive students who would say you also can't.
They don't want to read it.
They don't want to read it. It's traumatizing. So, you know.
The same rationale that the right wingers have, too, where they say it hurts the feelings of the white kids.
Yes.
I don't see why the white kids have to identify with
Justice
Kennedy.
I think it's a really interesting point that a lot of these objections participate in the same set of ideas about what challenging ideas do and how. So what I say to students, not necessarily specifically about Dred Scott, this has come up with like reading Homer. And I say, you know what Homer didn't do? He didn't use any fossil fuels his whole life. And what have you done today? How did you get to my campus? How did you get to campus today? Where was the electricity coming from? Like, if you want to think about like the thing that you will be held accountable, that we will be held accountable for, we are destroying the actual planet. And to sit around and say, like, I can't read Homer because I don't like his views on women is really to have lost all proportion.
Yeah.
Or to say, you know, we can't name a school after Thomas Jefferson. The local school board should make their decisions. I'm not trying to, but to say that we are blameless for moral failings is just to misunderstand the nature of the human condition. Like, yes, Madison knew how wrong that was, and he did not stop it. And people drove to this auditorium this evening in cars that are run by oil, and we understand how bad that is, and we still do it. And
some of them walked and took the bus.
I mean, I was always taught as a kid, you begin with yourself, and if you really are so virtuous in the universe that, you know, you can't be tainted by reading the works of people who in their lifetime made moral compromises,
yeah,
then I don't have anything to teach you.
Let's talk about guns and gun violence in the Second Amendment. A lot of my colleagues in Congress are absolutely convinced and insist that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to give the people the right to overthrow the government, which is why we can't ban the sale of AR-15s and other weapons of war on the streets of America. It's why we cannot have a universal violent criminal background check. This argument, which adopts the NRA orthodoxy on it now, suggests that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to give the people an arsenal at least equal to or greater than that of the government, so that if the government turns tyrannical, the people can engage in insurrection against the government.
I think Huey might not be strong enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we get in these debates, you know, I give a legalistic rebuttal to it. I say, well, you know, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to call forth the militias of the states in order to repel invasions and suppress insurrections. The Republican Guarantee Clause says that Congress must guarantee the people of the states a Republican form of government, not a Republican Party form of government, but a representative form of government, and must assist the states in suppressing domestic violence. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says that if you've served in office, you've sworn an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, and you violate the oath by engaging in insurrection or rebellion, you shall never be allowed to hold federal or state office again. Okay? So the language of the Constitution completely demolishes the argument that somehow the Second Amendment in invisible ink creates a right to overthrow the government. But what, as an historian, do you say to that argument, which is blockading us from passing the most simple, common sense reforms that are completely consistent mm-hmm. with the Second Amendment as spelled out by Justice Scalia mm-hmm. in Heller versus District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. What do you say to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the history is entirely as dispositive as the constitutional argument, right? It's not weaker than, it is an addition to, right? So there are a few things that one could point to, but one is, you know, the Second Amendment used to be called the Lost Amendment because it was never cited or used by anybody for any purpose whatsoever, because it was just understood within the states and in municipalities that if you know, you could have some gun safety regulations, and states and municipalities over the country always did. And the only time that it's not until 1939 in Miller versus U.S. that there is any claim that that the Second Amendment involves an individual right to bear arms. It's up until 1939, it is really just
militia-based.
It's just understood as like that you have a right to have a militia. And that, you know, the way you parse the sentence, you can go back to Madison's original phrasing or whatever, like, and it's a 9-0 decision. There is no individual right to it. In the case in 1939 was in 1934 and in 1938. Congress had passed the Federal Firearms Act and the National. I'm like, as if I'm explaining something to you that you already know. This is for you guys.
And the NRA, by the way, supported those.
And the NRA supported those. Yeah. And you know, there was a challenge to it, and the court's like, well, obviously the federal government has a right to pass these things. It was basically criminalizing machine guns, which is why we don't have machine guns anymore.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, from 1789 to 1939, nobody, it's like just not a thing. So what happens in 1968 when the Gun Control Act that's passed in response to the assassination of JFK finally gets through Congress, which also the NRA supported.
Yeah.
You just have to recover the political history from 1968 to 2023. And that is a very specific political history in which people on the pretty far right end of the Republican Party at that time, who are now the Republican Party, decided after 1968, and certainly by 1971, that gun rights would be a great white rights issue as a kind of backlash against civil rights. You know, there was a lot of backlash against civil rights, but the model of seeking constitutional rights through mass political movement and pressure on a court seemed to be a really good one. So the political idea was, we'll do that, but we'll do that for white men who are feeling aggrieved and left behind. And so this will be the thing that we will use. And it's a very emotional, it's easy to kind of gin people up about it by suggesting that it's a right that's about to be taken away from you. But in order to do that, you first have to invent the idea that it is such a right. And so there's just this enormous amount of work that goes on that's largely funded by the NRA, academics who get grants from the NRA, to kind of come up with this, the individual, not just the individual rights argument, but by the 80s, the insurrection argument, which is what lies behind, you know, Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City and the Michigan militia and those militia movements of the 90s.
And January 6th.
And gets you all the way down to January 6th.
Yeah.
And you think about, you know, I recognize people run for office and, you know, they have a kind of, I'm going to do what's necessary to win and then I'm going to do the right things. But then you think about the moral depravity of deciding to fight for that. To fight for the right for an armed nation to be able to stage an insurrection against a sitting Democratic government. That's your political move for generations.
Yeah. It's pretty shocking.
It's pretty shocking.
Yeah. I mean, when I point all this stuff out to them, they come back with two things. One, they say, well, what about Patrick Henry? He said, live free or die, which was like an 18th century bumper sticker, right? And and he was an anti-federalist who voted against the Constitution. So it would be like, you know, turning to Robert E. Lee to ask him for his views on the 14th Amendment or something, you know? So, and then they say, well, what about the American Revolution itself? The Declaration mm-hmm. of Independence, which does say absolutely when in the course of human events, if the government's turned tyrannical after a long mm-hmm. train of abuses and usurpations and so on. Yeah, but Jefferson never cited British law or the non-existent British Constitution or the Magna Carta. He said, as a matter of natural law, natural right, people can overthrow a government that turns tyrannical. So if you think that the 2020 presidential election, which Trump's Department of Homeland Security said was the most secure presidential election in American history, if you think that that was an exercise in tyranny akin to King George and what was happening against the colonists, then you can come and you can attack our officers and you can bloody the police and send everybody to the hospital and try to overthrow the election of the government. But if we catch you and we arrest you and we give you due process and the presumption of innocence and a jury of your peers finds that you're guilty, like Stuart Rhodes, the Yale Law School graduate head of the Oath Keepers, you're going to prison with hundreds of others of them. And that's where you belong if you want to overthrow our government. We don't have the only constitution on earth which gives you a right to destroy the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know? So.
The other thing I would say about that is, and what I would say to your pro-insurrection colleagues is, the triumph of the Constitutional Convention was actually Article 5. It was the ability to amend the Constitution, which was understood to be the alternative to insurrection. And when they sat around and they thought, what are we going to do about it when things need to change? We have to have something that people can do short of insurrection, or else the only way to change a government will be insurrection, which obviously nobody should be doing that. So you know what we should have? We should have an amendment provision. And the fact that that's broken is its own problem, but they didn't break it. They built it to be used.
That's exactly the point that Lincoln made too. I mean, Lincoln said, if you know, you can try to change things through elections, and if that doesn't work, you can amend the Constitution. But he said insurrection is a violation of the first principle of government, which is the people get to choose our leaders, not a mob that shows
up
and declares itself a militia. And by the way, it's very clear from the Constitution that the officers of militia are appointed by the state, and the Congress can regulate and organize the militias and call them. So the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, they are not a militia, no matter what they say. That is not the militia, and militias don't show up in kindergartens with AR-15s. I can't believe we're almost out of time here. Jill Lepore, I could go on for hours with you, but I've got to talk about your final essay, which takes issue somewhat with the report of the January 6th Select Committee.
The distinguished January 6th Select.
Yes. And nobody is safe from the critical eye of Jill Lepore. And, but I actually agreed with some of what you said in the essay. But your basic point is that it's very legalistic. It's very defined and focused in time to the months leading up to January 6th, the election, the manufacture of the big lie, a phrase that you don't like, and the mobilization of propaganda to undermine the election, and then the various assaults through the state legislatures, election officials like Brad Raffensperger, the hit on Vice President Pence to try to get him to step outside of his constitutional role just to anoint Trump the victor and so on. But you say that it's limited, it's narrow, it's way too focused. And I took you to be saying that we didn't deal with the larger historical forces that were in motion. And we didn't deal with, and here I'm agreeing with you, a lot of the larger forces that were present on that day, like white supremacy, like the domestic violent extremist groups, like Christian white nationalism, which was present, like the influence of this new social media and what all of that meant. And there was about maybe one person on the committee that wanted to do all that stuff, and you can guess who it was. That was me. But the others felt like that would direct attention away from the central culpability of Donald Trump, which I absolutely agree with. I mean, as a juridical matter, he was the one who set all of these events into motion leading up to what took place on January 6th. In fact, the right-wing groups that had obtained permits from the National Park Service had gotten them for January the 20th. They wanted a counter-protest against the inauguration, and it was Trump who got in touch with them and said, no, you've got to change it to January 6th. This thing's not over yet. You know, be there, we'll be wild. I mean, this all spun out of his imagination, and I could see that maybe we didn't want to confuse the picture by talking about the role the social media played in the dissemination of propaganda, or the role the social media played as an organizing tool for the people who were deploying forces around the Capitol and so on. But obviously, that left you dissatisfied as an historian or as a citizen customer of what we did in the committee. But I'm just wondering if at that point we've just arrived at a hard place of distinction between what mm-hmm. we can get away with in public life and what we can do, what we can focus on, versus what historians do. Yeah. And maybe it's more yeah. a challenge to you to pick up the baton and you write a history about what happened on January 6th.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, when that report was going to be about to come out, it was quite clear that people would be, the press would receive it, I think, would be very welcoming of the incredibly specific bill of indictments, essentially against Donald Trump. And the hearings had revealed so much, and I watched every second of the televised hearings and was vastly edified and shocked and fascinated. And what the investigation uncovered is, of course, crucially important to the ongoing now Justice Department and other investigations and indictments that are well underway. So it's not that I disagree with doing all of those things. I think my job, because I'm not just writing I'm not the New York Times op-ed columnist who's going to say the report came out and look at all these cool things that are really interesting and I bet you didn't know. We should really prosecute Donald Trump. My job is to say, as a historian, what is this thing? What is this 800-page document? Because, you know, the independent commission that I would have liked to see, that I think you would have liked to see, you know, was not authorized. There were not the votes. Republicans opposed that. So
they advocated it, and then they opposed it when Donald Trump changed his mind about it.
Yeah. Well, you have to do what he says whenever he says it.
You do.
Even sooner.
That's a principle of critical thinking.
Right. Yeah, so. He's just the guy. He's just one of those guys you really like. Yeah. So, you know, my question is, well, what would the commission, if you think about the 9/11 commission report, which is a very different kind of report, or the Warren commission report, or, yeah. you know, FDR commission report on the attack on Pearl Harbor, there are different kinds of findings.
But there's a political chemistry in each of those. I mean,
absolutely.
The 9/11 commission arguably pulled some punches
absolutely.
About
absolutely.
Saudi Arabia's role in yeah. the whole thing.
And, yeah. So, know. I mean, what was frustrating to me as a reader, I'm edified to understand the mechanism by which this thing happened, how these people came, who did what, which moved there, you know, the rook, the castle five, the queen, the king, the bishop, whatever. Like, yeah. if this happened, I'm glad to now I see the game, the play of game. But why, almost half the country still believes the election was stolen. Like, why do they believe, why? And until we can answer that question, I'm really worried about what happens next. So that's not the committee's brief, right? That's the historian's brief. Or is it the historian's brief? It's a journalist's brief. Like, historians don't have any idea what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
So when do we find out why? And I want to know the answer. So that's what was my disappointment.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to wait for some more historical analysis, you know, to get it all out there. But we all play our part, and nobody plays a more noble or beautiful part in understanding America today and America in the past in the world than Jill Lepore. Thank you for writing this awesome book.
Thanks.
And thanks to the Kentucky Author Forum. Thank you, University of Louisville. And thanks to the great people of Kentucky.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is produced by Evie Clare and is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's presented by the University of Louisville Kentucky Author Forum, Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. The forum is supported by the Owsley Brown II family, Bittners, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this great podversation. Thank you for listening. I look forward to your joining me for the next great podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.